I'm Jack Hopke, your host for the program this evening that I enjoy so much because we do so many different things with so many people. We're going to investigate a couple of development projects, including the newest instrument in the musical universe, the house. First, though, we're going to recall a recent very tragic incident with the hope that it may spur anti-crime efforts. As New Orleans marks the killing of a 44-year-old father gunned down as he walked his two children to a bus stop, officials are trying a new plan to get guns off the streets. Eileen Fleming reports it's the latest effort by Mayor Mitch Landrieu to enact what's working in some other American cities.
Mayor Landrieu and Police Superintendent Ronald Surpass are backing a program of higher bond for defendants facing illegal weapons charges and more electronic surveillance. Landrieu says it cut the murder rate in St. Louis by 20% last year. He's asking the criminal and municipal courts to require at least $30,000 in cash bonds for illegal weapons charges. Landrieu says the announcement came only hours after he learned of the murder of the Algiers man trying to prevent a carjacking.
I mean, my heart broke. Just an incredible tragedy. There's so much about that story that's tragic. I mean, obviously, no children should ever have to witness a family member being hurt.
Surpass says it's vital to get guns away from criminals.
In 2011, we know that 40% of the people arrested for murder had at least one prior illegal firearms charge in their life. And we know, unfortunately, that 33% of the victims in 2011 had the same condition. In 2012, year to date, it's half. 50% of the people we've arrested for murder in 2012 and 50% of the people who have died and their family has suffered their death had an illegal firearms charge in their background.
Landrieu and Surpass say all sections of the city are being adequately patrolled, and there's no immediate need for additional law enforcement backup, such as the National Guard. Landrieu says it's more important that all residents be involved in the fight against violence across the entire city.
That value of life and that culture of death that exists grips all of us. And as you can see right now, even though they are separate and distinct, they have a way of completely encapsulating every conversation and sucking the air out of communities when events continue to occur like this, and we have to get to the root cause of it.
Landrieu says stemming violent crime remains his number one priority. For WWNO, I'm Eileen Fleming.
Eileen Fleming is a correspondent here for our station, WWNO, and a frequent contributor to All Things New Orleans. I'm Jack Hopke. This is All Things New Orleans. We'll go to this week's Notes from New Orleans that we bring to you each week here on All Things New Orleans. Sharon Litwin is our next guest, who keeps her ear to the ground to hear from an articulate and underexposed rapper in New Orleans.
A few weeks ago, I was in a downtown coffee shop when an acquaintance introduced me to a gentleman I thought he called Truth Universal. I thought about that for several days and decided to find out if that really was what I heard. I not only found the gentleman, this is what I learned about him.
I'm an MC. The popular term for that is rapper, though.
The fact is, his name now really is Truth Universal, something this 38-year-old computer programmer imposed on himself in the mid-1990s, he says. He really believes a name should be what you are or what you aspire to be, and while there are those who think he's being arrogant, he says not so.
Truth Universal is my attribute, and I feel like an attribute is descriptive of who you are or who you aspire or what you aspire to be. And I'm not the absolute truth. That just speaks to me wanting to speak truthfully. I seek truth in life and I strive to speak it.
I have spent many years working in what is pompously called the high arts, museums, orchestras, those kinds of places. So to say that I'm not well educated in the world of rap and hip hop would be an understatement. But I know this, it is a potent force not only within our community, but nationally and now internationally. And I have learned that in New Orleans, we have our own form of that particular cultural expression.
I think the difference between the music here is like this music is akin to Mardi Gras Indian rhythms and the Bambula rhythms. A rhythm that's kind of at the base of it, like the native expression of hip hop here would be bounce. And it's just the way the beat hits. It's like this, it's a different syncopation, you know. The cadence is even different. You know, the rappers' cadence are different here. So you have people that rap different cadences, double time and what have you. That's a Southern thing, but it's a little bit different here because of how we hear the beats. I heard Irma Thomas talking to Waddell Kazelle about it. It's just a different way artists or people here hear the beats. So it's expressed a little differently. I would say because we're here, this is like where black music started. So this is the birthplace of jazz, the birthplace of blues. And hip-hop is naturally the child of those things. And you also find it in, like, church. And that would be things like, you know, the interaction, call and response. Like, you know, the congregation say, amen, amen. And in hip-hop, it would be like, let me hear you say ho, or like, when I say so, you say this, so this.
And while these mixings of music and scratch sounds, rhythm and rhyming poetry have created this whole new genre of popular sound, some might wonder why there is such an element of anger in many of them.
This art form, these art forms are the art forms of oppressed people, right? So you have the voice of oppressed people here. Everybody can't speak, but these are the sentiments that a lot of us have. It's going to be aggressive because that's the environment that a lot of us are in. So you're going to get that aggression, and it's going to be directed in different ways. It may be destructive, and it may be a constructive aggression. If you don't understand that, it may be disturbing, but that's the nature of hip-hop. And to understand why it is what it is, you have to study the experiences of the people. So what I strive to do with my music is to affect social change in some form or fashion. And that doesn't mean you're just going to listen to my music and, you know, and everything's going to be different. First, we have to start dialogue, and that's what I hope people do when they listen to what I do. Not just if you don't like how it sounds or what was said, don't turn a deaf ear to it. Think about it. Why was it said? Talk about it with someone else.
So there you are. That is New Orleans' own Truth Universal, someone with a very definite point of view, born out of his own life experiences and a reflection of New Orleans. For more information on New Orleans hip-hop and rap, go to WWNO.org or NolaVie, NolaVie.com. For WWNO, this is Sharon Lippman. You might call me hater, but that ain't my mode. Define my own language, music
can't dress cold. I'm filled with pain. Speak my brain. The very versatile and curious Sharon Lippman is the former executive director of the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra and the co-founder of NolaVie.com. The essence and it's filled with aggression, exploited by the foreign, but it's still my possession. Black culture turned to profession, born from conditions shaped by oppression. Struggle is the essence filled with aggression. And this is WWNO's All Things New Orleans. You can always hear our features at WWNO.org. Listen again, share them. It's our website, WWNO.org. And I'm Jack Hopke, your host here each week for this program. Let's double back. I introduced Kathleen Osborne a few minutes before Sharon joined us, but we didn't get to hear her fine piece on the group of artists that has transformed a blighted local property into a structure that makes music. Let's go once again to Kathleen's visit.
It's called the Music Box. In fact, it's a small village of ramshackle sculptures huddled together on Piety Street in the Bywater section of the once-flooded Ninth Ward. They're outfitted as musical instruments and made almost entirely of the remains from the 18th century Creole cottage that used to sit on this lot. Curator Delaney Martin points to a rotating organ speaker on top of half an A-frame shack called the Heartbeat House.
A stethoscope plays your heartbeat through a spinning Leslie speaker. It spins round and round and, you know, unlike a church bell calls people to congregation or an alarm, what we want to have is a heartbeat, this primal beat that calls to the people of New Orleans and says, come out and dance, come out and sing, come out and have fun.
Local and national artists were invited to dream up the instruments and structures that inhabit the lot. Taylor Lee Shepherd is a mechanical sculptor who moved to the city after Hurricane Katrina. He's built a singing wall that samples and plays back the voices that fill the home.
Just start recording people as they come through, little kids, and anybody that seems interested or curious, and it'll just change all throughout the day, and I'll have all these different textures and rhythms all mixed together. It sums up a moment in time.
These structures are an experimental first step towards building a fully functional musical house that will be the headquarters and residency space for the New Orleans Airlift. The organization was created after Katrina to raise the profile of local artists, often through collaborations with more famous creators. New York-based street artist Callie Curry, known as Swoon, designed the house for Airlift.
I hope it represents this very basic need in people while rebuilding, to rebuild joyfully and with imagination.
Transforming that hope into reality by bringing in outsiders is a touchy subject in the city, says Music Box associate curator Theo Elizer, who grew up in New Orleans.
There's a lot of resentment that existed over the past 6 years of people coming to New Orleans to contribute in a way that was about fixing New Orleans, and there were legitimate things that needed to be fixed, like houses that were flooded. But culturally, we didn't need to be fixed, and our communities didn't need to be fixed.
Everyone involved in the project is keenly aware of striking the right balance in a city where Hurricane Katrina turned long-term homeowners into renters. Jay Pennington is Airlift's co-director.
There is a natural antipathy in this neighborhood to seeing anyone do anything with a house that's not going to put somebody in it to live. And it's something that people are really sensitive about here.
As the city continues the long process of rebuilding, Pennington and Delaney Martin hope the final house will be an example of the beauty that can emerge from all of that destruction.
I, amongst many of my other artist friends, can look at an old falling down house and see a great deal of beauty, see a great deal of salvageable materials, and see a great deal of inspiration. What I don't want to see, as much as I want blight to be resolved, I would hate to see all these beautiful old properties bulldozed and thrown away and new developments put in. That's not our neighborhood anymore if we do that. So this was our answer to it. And I think what was important to us to create out of this blight is a sense of wonder and possibility.
Yeah.
We have 30 school children in the yard right now, so I'm going to go attend to them. You're welcome to join.
15-year-old D'Angelo Falk, who came with a group of students from the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts, tried out the musical rocking chair.
What do you think?
It's so cool. I think this is the most best music I have ever made on my own. Very artistic. I've never seen something like this, and I live in the neighborhood.
And that's the point, says Delaney Martin.
Right across the way there, across this big street on the other bad side of the tracks, there is this utter lack of wonder and possibility. There's a lot of closed doors. There's not many options. And what I hope that, you know, can happen is that they can come here to the Music Box, which is really like a Peter Pan wonderland, and remember this blighted house and now see this sort of resurrected, amazing thing, and that does have value, because when you don't have options and you see something that totally is from another world, that is about expanding your imagination and your options. And I think that there's true value in that.
As one neighbor put it, the Music Box also brings something else to their community, hope. For NPR News, I'm Kathleen Osborne.
Kathleen Osborne is a freelance writer and multimedia producer based out of Cambridge, Massachusetts. All things New Orleans, Thursday the 26th. We're here each Thursday evening at 6:35. Glad you joined us tonight. I'm Jack Hopke. And now for that operetta, a comic operetta. Last seen in New Orleans more than a century ago, it's going to be performed by the Loyola University Opera. Diane Max with us. She's got the story behind Jacques Offenbach's The Grand Duchess of Gerolstein.
It's light, it's fun, it has that militaristic swagger about it.
Loyola Opera music director and conductor Carol Rausch is talking about the first local revival of Jacques Offenbach's classic comedy, The Grand Duchess of Gerolstein.
I enjoy digging stuff up like this. It was premiered in Paris in 1867, and actually came to New Orleans the very same year in English with a traveling group of players. And then the following year was done at the French Opera House in French and stayed there for a couple decades, really, and then passed out of the repertoire. And it hasn't been revived locally since, although there have been a number of important remounts of the work. Santa Fe Opera, they did it in Philadelphia, Boston, and I think even New York City Opera, but we haven't done it here. So a lot of people are looking forward to it for that very reason.
The operetta was a controversial work in its day, a satire on German militarism of the late 19th century, with war-making portrayed as a bumbling effort. I asked Rausch how the new production, which she likens to a Broadway show, was being handled.
We're doing it as several modern productions have done in the World War I era, and it means all our chorus guys can have those cute little doughboy uniforms with the tin helmets and stuff like that. World War II is a little tricky with the German component there, shall we say. So World War I makes it fun, and the soldiers are kind of like Keystone Cops, frankly, in their efforts to wage war. One thing that we've done also is trim the score down. It's a long piece. We've got it down to about 2.5 hours and keeping all the best tunes.
I wondered why all this talk about a military satire. Rausch says the Grand Duchess of Gerolstein was a rather spoiled young woman who was about to enter into an arranged marriage
with kind of a doddering old guy named Prince Paul, and that's not making her very happy. So those around her, mostly yes men types, have decided, well, let's go to war. That'll maybe raise her spirits. So she decides to take charge, even though she's had no experience, and she reviews the troops and immediately falls in love with the dashing but not very bright Private Fritz. And she's so enamored that she promotes him from private to corporal and then up the ranks, lieutenant, captain, colonel, and finally makes him in charge of the whole thing. And General Boom, the real commander-in-chief, is demoted back down. So he and the prime minister and Prince Paul, the rejected betrothed, sort of form an alliance to get Fritz out of the picture. And eventually the Duchess joins them because Fritz really has a fiancé named Wanda that he's much more interested in than the Duchess. But by the end, everything is restored to where it should be. Fritz and Wanda are together. General Boom gets reinstated. And the Duchess resigns herself to marry Prince Paul, saying something like, if we can't have what we like, we must like what we have. So...
If you're in the mood for light and tuneful entertainment, Offenbach's The Grand Duchess of Gerolstein just might fill the bill. The operetta is being presented as part of Loyola's Montage Fine and Performing Arts series, with performances tomorrow at 7:30 p.m. and an encore matinee Sunday at 3 at Roussel Hall in the Communications Music Complex on Loyola University's campus. Inside the Arts for 89.9 WWNO, I'm Diane Mack.
Diane Mack hosts Morning Edition here on WWNO weekdays. Program starts at 4 a.m. And we're All Things Considered, your weekly news magazine here on the radio at WWNO. I'm Jack Hopke. From rap to opera, where else? Years after Hurricane Katrina, now the rebuilding of our region continues with sometimes surprising results. NPR's Richard Gonzalez recently visited our city, and he sent NPR this audio postcard about a man who built the house of his dreams.
Driving through Araby, Louisiana, on the outskirts of New Orleans, empty lots easily outnumber the homes that survived Katrina. But nothing prepares a visitor for the sight of Gerald Brady's house.
Man, I got people all over the world come here and take pictures.
I believe it.
You'd be surprised, you know?
Brady, a former shipyard welder, has built a two-story log cabin sitting on top of 8-foot-high concrete piers.
The house is from the bottom to the top is 30 feet, and underneath is 8 foot. Let's go inside, and then I'll show you inside.
Brady says he bought the lot a few years ago for $5,000 and then sat on it for another year and a half,
All the other houses nearby are made of brick.
I said, I got tired looking at the house. I said, man, I got to build me a log cabin.
Why a log cabin?
Well, since I was a kid, I've been wanting a log cabin. I seen them years ago, you know, in the olden days, you know, the good times, you know, the cowboys and all that. They had log cabins and all that. So I said, well, let me build me one.
It took Brady another year and about $90,000 to build the cabin. He says the building was the easy part. The hard part was getting the permits from out-of-town inspectors.
The last permit guy come out here from Oregon. He come out here and he said, nobody don't know what they're doing. I said, I think I can build anything I want. And I said, it look like you don't know what you're doing, you know, because I used to build ships and everything. If I can't build anything, I might as well hang it up.
The inspectors forced him to hire an engineer, says Brady, but that was all right with him.
And that's how I got the log cabin built, you know, after 3.5 years. Let's go upstairs. I'm going to show you upstairs.
From upstairs, you can see down on the rest of a neighborhood that Brady says was submerged in more than 20 feet of water after Katrina.
Really? All the swamp, mud, and everything came in here. They had fish, shrimp, everything, snakes and all in here. I tell you, it was unreal, you know. You had to see it to believe it. But nature takes its course.
And Brady is convinced that something like Katrina will happen again. And when it does, he says he hopes to be standing tall in what he calls his log cabin watchtower here in Araby, Louisiana. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News.
Richard Gonzalez is NPR's national desk correspondent based in San Francisco. He's a co-founder of Familias Unidas, a bilingual social services program in his hometown of Richmond, California. We're going to play our way out of our January 26th edition of All Things New Orleans now. Hope you've enjoyed it. You can always hear our features again at our website, wwno.org. By the way, we're going to debut our new site very soon. We think you're going to like it, too. Thanks to our contributors, to executive producer Paul Mawson, and to producer and editor Thomas Walsh. I'm Jack Hopke. See you next Thursday. Broadcasting in HD from the University of New Orleans, it's your source for NPR news and great classical music. 89.9 WWNO New Orleans, 90.5 KTLN Thibodaux Houma, and online at WWNO.org.